This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with criminal defense attorney Chase Aboudin about a lawsuit in San Francisco challenging the cash bail system.
Used to be out there that if you had a lot of money, you could get yourself out and help prepare your own trial. If you didn't have a lot of money, you were in trouble. Things now are evened out between rich and poor.
An ongoing lawsuit in federal court is challenging access of protesters to the inaugural parade route this coming January.
For all those people who are quite worried about what the Trump presidency will bring, the question now is, can they even go out and demonstrate against him?
In our ongoing dispatches from the encampment at Standing Rock, today we speak with Eleanor Bravo, who has just returned from there.
It's coming down to crunch time as to whether this protest, unprecedented in American history, is going to make a dent. Let's see what she has to say.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The purpose of a criminal defendant being forced by the state to post bail in order to be released prior to his or her trial is to ensure that the defendant show up for trial. This is the only purpose of bail. The importance of securing pretrial release is that it allows for the criminal defendant to help prepare his or her own defense, something that is difficult to do if a person is behind bars. This is an inherently discriminatory situation with respect to poor people who do not have the money to post cash bail or even to pay the 10% fee necessary to borrow it from a bail bond agent. We speak today with San Francisco criminal defense attorney Chase Aboudin, who is involved in a lawsuit which successfully challenged an aspect of this discriminatory cash bail system. In 2011, Chase completed his law degree at Yale Law School. He was a Rhodes Scholar and earned two master's degrees from Oxford University. Chase has translated, edited, and authored several books. His scholarly law articles cover a range of topics such as direct democracy, immigration, institution building, the rights of children with incarcerated parents, and prison visitation policies. Chase Aboudin is currently a trial lawyer at the San Francisco Public Defender.
Chase Aboudin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Let's start by defining what is bail and what role does it play in our criminal justice system?
Bail is a historic practice in the United States and beyond in which people can pay money to secure their freedom pending trial. And the role it plays in the United States is, not to put too fine a point on it, to ensure that the wealthy can fight criminal charges from freedom, and that the poor cannot.
And doesn't it also give a good appearance before a judge if an individual can raise bail and then go back to the community and hopefully try to do some good before sentence is imposed?
Well, yes. I mean, it's even more significant than simply sentencing. It also has to do with the ability to successfully fight charges against you. A person who is accused of a crime and is free can assist their lawyer in, you know, visiting crime scenes and obtaining evidence, speaking to witnesses, reviewing discovery. They can communicate privately and conveniently with family, friends, and legal counsel. A person who's incarcerated, on the other hand, may well lose their job, their home, custody of their children, their car, and have all of their communications monitored by the jail staff, and any letters or phone calls or visits can be used against them. And of course, then there's the fact that lots of research has showed when a person is incarcerated pending trial, they're more likely to be convicted, they're more likely to be sentenced to jail time, as compared to someone who is out of custody during the pendency of the case. And one of the reasons for that is simply sort of the bias that a judge feels when they see someone who's already in orange and when they see someone who's already been largely disconnected from their community by virtue of their incarceration. And then the other one is that people plead guilty in order to get out of jail. And so what I see with tremendous frequency in my practice as a public defender in San Francisco is prosecutors who ask for judges to impose tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in bail on one of my clients, but then at the same time say, if he pleads guilty, he can get out of jail today, credit for time served. And what that does is it puts tremendous pressure on people, regardless of the strength of the prosecution's case, regardless of guilt or innocence, to take a deal so they can get out and go back to their lives and waive all of their constitutional rights to fight the charges against them. If you're out of custody, there's no reason you'd ever do that. But if you're in custody due to your poverty and inability to pay bail, it happens every day that you plead guilty. Somebody pleads guilty to something they may not have done simply because it's the only way they can get out.
Chase, before we talk about your lawsuit, can you just briefly describe the difference between posting cash bail or a percentage fee from a bail bonds agent? How does that work?
So almost everybody who bails out goes through a bail bond agency. And the traditional business model for bail bond agencies is that they accept a payment or a commitment to pay 10% of the bail amount. And in exchange, they put up the promise to pay the court the full amount if you should fail to appear. So to be a little bit more concrete, imagine that you're arrested for something and the judge sets $100,000 bail. Most people don't have $100,000 cash lying around, but the bail bond industry will usually offer to pay the full $100,000 in exchange for the $10,000 or 10% paid by the person who's in custody or their family, only on the condition that you don't get any of that money back at the end of the case. Now, traditionally, if you put up the full amount of money at the end of the case, win or lose, the full amount of money comes back to you. In other words, the court will return your $100,000 to you. But if you don't have the $100,000, you go to a bail bond agency, you pay them $10,000 that will never come back to you, and they promise the court that they will pay the full $100,000 should you fail to appear at some future point during the pendency of the case. So basically, it's a way for the bail bond industry to make money. And from a public policy standpoint, you could very easily have courts reduce the amount they're charging by 90%. People would still be paying the same amount, but then you wouldn't have this private industry making a huge profit along the way.
Chase, you haven't been out of law school very long, and you took on this quite impressive lawsuit. Why did you decide to challenge money bail?
Well, it was something that I saw every day in my practice as a public defender having a really disproportionate and discriminatory impact on the poorest of my clients. And it just seemed like such a fundamentally unfair part of the criminal justice system, and one that had longer downstream repercussions in terms of coercing guilty pleas from people due to their poverty, that it really felt to me like an anathema to any sense of justice or fairness or equity in the criminal justice system. And it just seems like waiving your constitutional rights and pleading guilty is something that has lifelong consequences. It's a decision that should be made with a sort of sober, reasoned, carefully considered analysis, not one under the duress of incarceration due to poverty.
Chase, can you share with us a little information about the plaintiffs in your lawsuit?
So there's two named plaintiffs, lead plaintiffs, in what was filed as a putative class action. The first one is a woman named Rihanna Buffin. And Ms. Buffin was working at the Oakland Airport at the time she was arrested. She had no prior criminal history whatsoever, and she was arrested allegedly for participating in some kind of a scheme to return clothes to a department store that hadn't been purchased, basically a low-level petty theft type allegation. She had absolutely no prior convictions. The evidence against her was quite weak, but she didn't have the money to pay the bail that was set. And so she sat in jail for approximately 3 days until the district attorney decided not to even file charges against her. because the evidence was so weak. And by the time she was released, we had filed our lawsuit, but she had also lost her job at the Oakland airport. No charges were ever filed against her in criminal court. She never appeared in front of a judge. Miss Crystal Patterson is the other named plaintiff. And Miss Patterson was She was arrested and booked on assault. Bail was set at $150,000. Before she ever saw a judge, she called all of her family and friends she could, and they found a bail bond agency willing to accept 1% of the $150,000, just $1,500 cash, with a promise to pay the remaining 10% in installments, potentially with interest, on an installment plan. Miss Patterson was thus able to bail herself out just hours before the district attorney discharged the case against her. Again, she has no prior arrests, no prior convictions of any kind that we're aware of, and nevertheless, she was held in jail for several days, forced to sign a contract to pay $15,000 to get out, and had she been able to wait a couple hours, as it turns out, the district attorney would have just never filed charges against her, but she's still on the hook to the bail bond company for the $15,000 because of that contract. So it's a real example of how there are very real economic consequences for people caught up in the criminal justice system, even when no charges are ever filed against them, and how those consequences would not apply to people with more money who could put up the full amount themselves.
Chase, so what is new or different about the legal argument in the Buffen lawsuit?
So Buffen raises a equal protection and due process claim rather than simply looking at excessive bail. Historically, most bail litigation has focused on the bail clause of the Eighth Amendment, which says excessive bail shall not be set. But the body of law and jurisprudence on the bail clause of the Eighth Amendment is actually quite weak. It doesn't have a lot of teeth. It hasn't been read as having much meaning by courts. On the other hand, liberty is widely recognized as a fundamental right. And when a fundamental right is at issue, as it is when it comes to pretrial incarceration, there is actually quite strong precedent for saying that strict scrutiny applies, that a policy cannot discriminate based on wealth or race or any other category if a fundamental liberty or fundamental right is implicated. And of course, with something like bail, we know that rich people can buy their freedom and poor people are stuck in jail until they can resolve their case. And so that deprivation of liberty based on wealth status, our argument is, violates equal protection. Moreover, because neither Ms. Patterson nor Ms. Buffen saw a judge for days, we're arguing it's a due process violation. For the sheriff to arbitrarily set bail based on what's called a bail schedule of each listed offense without any consideration of individualized circumstances, of the strength of the case, of the criminal history, of the community ties, of the individual, is a due process violation because they're being held on an arbitrary amount of money without any process, any opportunity to be heard, to present evidence, to show why they should be allowed to go home to their families and their jobs.
I understand that the city attorney, sheriff in San Francisco announced a refusal to defend against the suit. What are the implications of that?
Well, let me first say I'm ecstatic that they took the position they took. I wish they had taken it sooner. We litigated this case for a full year before they took that position. And during that year, they tried every trick in the book to get the suit dismissed on procedural or technical or jurisdictional grounds. So while they deserve a tremendous amount of credit and their statement to the court on November 1st was courageous, it took a year, more than a year, to get there with them, a year of protracted litigation. Now, the implications thus far are not entirely certain. They refused to defend the suit, but the bail bond industry, basically the association of lobbyists that represents bail bond companies, has filed a motion to intervene. They want to defend the statute. And it may be that the Attorney General of California wants to defend the statute as well. The Buffen suit is due to jurisdictional filing requirements, limited to pre-arraignment money bail, meaning, as I said, both Ms. Buffin and Ms. Patterson never appeared in front of a judge, and the court, the federal court hearing this lawsuit, has limited its consideration to people in similar circumstances, meaning once a person accused of a crime appears in front of a judge and the judge sets bail, that's beyond the scope of this lawsuit. So we're currently working on filing suits that would challenge that later procedure, you know, that procedure where judges set bail, not just the bail automatically set by the schedule and imposed by the sheriff. However, for purposes of the Buffin suit, the key thing for now is, I think this is an example to sheriffs across the country that they can be on the right side of history, that it's consistent with public safety and public policy concerns for sheriffs to support moving away from wealth-based determination of confinement and liberty and moving towards risk-based determination of pretrial incarceration to ensure that we're letting people out who are low risk, not who are rich, that we're keeping people in only if they're high risk, not because they're poor. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity for other law enforcement and jurisdictions around the country to follow San Francisco's lead. And there's some reason to be optimistic that's happening. Just in the last couple of days, the sheriff of Chicago, who has been sued in a very similar lawsuit by our partners on the Buffin suit, Civil Rights Corps, together with other Chicago-based organizations, the sheriff in Chicago announced in response to that litigation that he thinks that they should move away from money bail, exactly as San Francisco did. So we're seeing something of a domino effect where, both for political reasons as well as because of the success of these legal arguments in court, one jurisdiction after another is saying, let's move towards a more sound public policy approach to determining who needs to be incarcerated pending trial and who should be released. And that has nothing to do with wealth, but rather with risk.
What are your thoughts with the Trump administration's promise to restore so-called law and order? Do you think reforms such as this will heighten in response to perhaps a harsher federal government's clampdown on crime?
Well, I think it's a little too early to say. And to be sure, the Clinton era, the Bill Clinton era, was a terrible era in terms of criminal justice policy and reform. And Merrick Garland, who President Obama appointed to fill Justice Scalia's seat on the Supreme Court, I think would have been probably worse when it comes to criminal justice issues than Justice Scalia himself was. As conservative as he was, when it came to the Fourth Amendment, he was one of its champions in a way that Judge Garland has not been on the D.C. Circuit. So I think it's very much too early to tell what exactly the implications of a Trump presidency are for criminal justice reform. But I'm not optimistic that he'll do anything positive. I think he'll empower police departments that are already emboldened to use excessive force with impunity. I think he'll empower prosecutors to continue overcharging and to continue withholding exculpatory evidence with impunity. I think that's a very dangerous thing for the integrity of the criminal justice system and for public safety. I hope that jurisdictions around the country, local jurisdictions like Chicago, like San Francisco, will continue to move forward around these sorts of reforms that save money, increase public safety, and do it in a way that makes the system more equitable and less destructive to communities, particularly communities of color and poor folks who are caught up in the criminal justice system. San Francisco and California legislators have gone on record since Trump's election and said that they will refuse to accept federal funding if that's what it takes to maintain political independence and continue to be true to the values and the principles that our local population base supports. And so I'm hopeful that that will continue to happen despite what I expect will be a very rough 4 years when it comes to criminal justice policy at the federal level.
Well, Chase, we want to thank you for this really heartening and exemplary work, and we look forward to staying in touch with you as it develops.
Yeah, and Chase, I just can't resist saying that I knew your grandfather, Leonard Boudin, who was, of course, the great constitutional lawyer of a half century ago, and you're really following in his footsteps. It's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to follow in those footsteps and to speak with you again. Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks,
Chase. Take it easy. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
How close will protesters be allowed to get to the inaugural parade route in D.C. this January 20th? 2 months before Donald Trump is sworn in as president, First Amendment advocates appeared in federal court to urge that demonstrators have access to the sidewalk in front of Trump's luxury hotel and the nearby Freedom Plaza. This case was filed long before Trump was elected and continues ongoing litigation over National Park Service regulations that determine the location of Inauguration Day demonstrations. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund recently argued the case for the Answer Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. As protesters converge across the country, thousands of individuals deemed by Trump to be, quote, professional protesters, have taken to the streets with renewed vigor. It is likely that an unprecedented number will converge on the nation's capital for this inauguration. Government attorneys told the court that the Park Service has long set aside space on the parade route for the incoming president's organization to plan a day of, quote, national celebration, and that protesters will have, quote, ample prime alternatives to engage in First Amendment activities along Pennsylvania Avenue. The government estimates that 84% of the sidewalks along the parade route are not off-limits for protest. The Presidential Inaugural Committee is a private entity controlled by the president-elect and responsible for planning most of the inaugural celebration activities, including selling tickets to the parade. Joining us today to talk about this legal challenge to the parade route is Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition. Brian Becker, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Brian, how long has litigation by Answer been going on over protesters' access to the inaugural parade route, and what have the outcomes been?
Well, the litigation has gone on since before the 2005 inauguration. That would be the second inauguration of George W. Bush, January 20th, 2005. The litigation has been, it's had many different pieces to it, many different iterations. It's had ups and downs. It's had victories. It's had some setbacks recently at the federal district court level. The real issue is whether the public, whether the people, whether people who want to express viewpoint, who have want to exercise free speech, will have access to the inaugural parade route on Inauguration Day on Pennsylvania Avenue, what is popularly known as America's Main Street, in order to tell the incoming administration, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, what they believe is important. In other words, do they have a right to address the government, to redress grievances, to assemble peacefully? And step by step, the National Park Service, using a variety of public rationales and legal rationales, has tried to make Pennsylvania Avenue off limits, in essence, for free speech protest, to make American democracy nothing more than a staged, managed democracy. And so the litigation is extremely important because now the government has, after the Answer Coalition in 2009, the first inauguration of President Obama, succeeded in negotiating half of Freedom Plaza for its own bleachers. Half was the Presidential Inaugural Committee, half was the Answer Coalition. In other words, the right to be there at the prime spot in Freedom Plaza, named after Dr. Martin Luther King, across the street from the hotel where he penned his famous 1963 I Have a Dream speech. After we succeeded, as a consequence of the litigation, to have access to Freedom Plaza, the National Park Service then rewrote the regulations and then set aside Freedom Plaza as the exclusive use of the Presidential Inaugural Committee, whoever it might be. Now it'll be the Trump Presidential Inaugural Committee, so that demonstrators will be banned from this historic place of free speech along parade route. And the Presidential Inaugural Committee, just for your listeners, is a private corporate profit-making entity. It raises tens of millions of dollars from corporate and banking donors and other rich donors, and then doles out seats along the inaugural parade route for its supporters, and is now successfully, if they hope, unless we succeed at the Circuit Court of Appeals, banishing free speech protest in these prime spots.
So, clarify for me, Freedom Plaza, will people with tickets from the committee be allowed to congregate there? Are there bleachers there?
Yes, there will be bleachers in Freedom Plaza and in many other areas of the parade route. It used to be that the public could just come to Pennsylvania Avenue, but starting around the late 1990s, during the last years of the Clinton administration, there was an effort to more and more, and incrementally but in a very dynamic way, privatize Pennsylvania Avenue on inauguration day, and thus the access to the bleachers would be for ticketed people. Now, during the George W. Bush administration, people, meaning the public, thought they could get access to the bleachers by calling Ticketmaster. But we learned through this litigation, filed on behalf of the Answer Coalition by the D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, that whole thing was actually a scam. When the public called Ticketmaster to get their tickets on Inauguration Day, a day that the courts have ruled is the least public day in American politics, when they called Ticketmaster to get their tickets, unless they had a secretly given code, which was a code only reserved for donors, they would never actually get tickets. So the public could call and call and call, but they weren't on the private list, the dark list that allowed them to actually get tickets. We learned about that through this litigation, that this scam was being perpetrated against the American people. Now it's out in the open. It says the Presidential Inaugural Committee, again, a private profit-making corporate entity, has exclusive right to dole out tickets, and the tickets are, of course, reserved for the big donors. So it's government of, by, and for money, the plutocracy during the elections, and I guess that's what the courts mean to have happen for inauguration too, unless, again, we prevail, and we may prevail at the Court of Appeals level. We were just in court this last Monday. The Partnership for Civil Justice did oral arguments arguing the assertion that there was no compelling interest, no significant interest, and certainly the government's recent assertion that this is now a form of government speech and protected as government speech to give away Pennsylvania Avenue was not in accordance with the Constitution. It was just dubious. And we'll find out what happens. But regardless, Heidi, of whether we get the permit or not, and certainly we have the right to have the permit, and it's existentially important for free speech rights that people have these rights, there's no doubt that because of the Trump administration and because of the odious right-wing bigoted policies it's pursuing against Latinos and Muslims, tens of thousands, I'd say perhaps hundreds of thousands of people are coming to Washington to say no to those policies.
Two questions. I want to talk a little bit more about the distinction between government and private speech and where the president-elect's committee falls on that spectrum. But what you just raised, the issue of perhaps record unprecedented turnouts, as we've seen from the protests around the country just in the week after the election results, do you think the anticipation of such huge protest turnouts might in any way influence the court's decision on this?
It's very hard to say. We do know, though, that judges live in society. They don't live up on some cloud up in the sky. They are certainly impacted by politics. They're impacted by what's going on socially. They're certainly and can't help but be impacted by large numbers of people being in the streets. I mean, if you go back to all of the major progressive decisions by the courts, starting with the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education, the desegregation of public schools, and all of the later decisions by the courts, including Roe v. Wade, which happened during the Nixon era, where women won the right to have an abortion, the right to control their own bodies, all of that came within a social context. And the social context was, I would say, dominated by the fact that social justice movements had mobilized the population, that the population instead of being spectators, had become actors in the political process. And undoubtedly, that impacts all institutions of power, including legal institutions of power.
Brian, if Heidi and I and our producer, Jeff Brady, want to go down to D.C. and tell the people around Trump and Trump himself what we think about him, what are our chances of getting near it?
I think you should assume your chances are good if you get there early. There's a number of obstacles that now exist for people gaining access to the parade route. Not all of the parade route is closed for exclusive use by the Presidential Inaugural Committee. What we're contesting is that the prime spots, the most visible spots, have been reserved for the Presidential Inaugural Committee. That doesn't mean that there's no space available. We're demanding that the people's right to speech, the right to speak out, be such and be given the same status it's always had so that we have visible areas. But people should come to Washington and participate. First, you have to get through a checkpoint. We and the Answer Coalition will put up on its website the things that we know the government will take away from you should you try to go through the checkpoint with them. Some of them are things that you would not anticipate, so it's important to know what the restrictions are. So after you get through the checkpoints, then you have to get to areas where protesters are gathering and assembling. My guess is that they will be assembling all up and down the parade route, because wherever people can kind of come in, they will come in. And because the feelings are so strong, the emotions are so profound in opposition to Trump's open racism, open bigotry, open religious and racial bigotry and profiling, that huge parts of the American population are going to want to be there. And thus, I think we will be successful. We are successful when people, in spite of whatever obstacle, decide to exercise their rights. If you have rights and you don't exercise them, you can't have an impact. But no matter what attempted restrictions or obstacles are placed in our path, if the people, the broad majority of the people who believe, as we do, in justice, exercise their rights, are willing to, and determined to take a stand, then we can make a big, big impact on the inaugural parade route during that day.
Brian, speaking of a big, big impact, what kind of police response do you expect to the protests this year?
Well, we expect the police to uphold the law. The law is quite clear, and the law has been changed in the District of Columbia, again, as a consequence of really feverish litigation that's been pursued by the Partnership for Civil Justice. You know, it used to be during the first Bush inauguration in 2001, and certainly in the next couple of years during the Iraq War, when we were having demonstrations literally of hundreds of thousands of people month after month, we were routinely hemmed in by police on motorcycles. There were lots of forays, police attacks, tear gas, pepper spray, beatings. All of that was a commonplace in Washington, D.C. During the first years. But again, and some of us were mass arrested. We were hogtied after we were arrested. We were, in other words, being punished by the police for trying to exercise not only our right, but our right to go to trial. I mean, it was like an amazing situation. There was litigation, again, by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and that litigation resulted in vast injunctive relief provisions by the federal government and by the D.C. government, and it was codified into D.C. law such that it's much easier to protest without fear of police violence in Washington, D.C. than it is in other cities, say in New York City, where the same kind of injunctive relief has not been achieved as of yet. So I think people should think you can get there, you can have, this will be a peaceful protest, people should bring their families, you bring your kids, bring your grandparents. In other words, our power is in our numbers, and people should really come. They should not be afraid. They should not listen to media accounts that try to tell them, stay away. The only way, again, that our democracy works, the only way we work as a people, is if we exercise our rights.
Well said, Brian. When do you expect the court to rule on this?
We don't really know. You know, it's conceivable that the courts might not rule until after the inauguration. That is one variant possibility. We certainly hope that they do rule, and they do rule ahead of time on our behalf, because we feel, and we sense a great dubiousness on the part of the panel of judges at the D.C. Court of Appeals about the assertion by the government that the pick, the Donald Trump presidential inaugural committee selling donor tickets or tickets to donors to dominate Pennsylvania Avenue was a form of government speech. I mean, can you imagine that that's now government? I mean, it's one thing when the government makes license plates and they say we have the right as a government to determine what's going to be on a license plate, but they're trying to exempt free speech areas, historic areas of free speech expression, for Donald Trump's presidential inaugural committee and say that's a form of government speech. I mean, it's ridiculous on its face. It's also ridiculous because a part of the regulations also state that if the bleachers are not completely full 10 minutes after the parade starts, then people can come first come, first serve. So in other words, then protesters against Trump's policy could fill into those bleachers in those 10 minutes. And would that be government speech? I mean, on its face, it's just a ridiculous argument. But it's a dangerous argument because should they prevail here, that would mean the government can declare any traditional free speech zone to be, for some reason, government speech and thus not subject to traditional free speech regulations in terms of government conduct.
And that's the crux of the argument in the lawsuit, isn't it? That this is not government speech because they're being paid for by fundraisers.
Exactly. Well, we have a number of arguments. What the reason the government speech issue became an issue in the litigation. The government itself had not previously argued it, but in ruling against our assertion, our rights, earlier, the federal district court adopted an argument that had not even been provided by the government up until that time, which is that we should be kept off of Pennsylvania Avenue because the PIC was, in effect, an expression of government speech. And then the government attorneys adopted the court's argument, which is a spurious argument, again, on its face. And you could see in the Court of Appeals oral arguments on Monday, there was a lot of, I don't know, it's hard to predict, but it seemed to me that to be a lot of skepticism from the Court of Appeal judges about that claim.
We hope so. Now, Brian, Michael and I wanted in our remaining few minutes to get your predictions about some of the new threats that we will face from this administration. What do you think are the key points we should be mindful of?
Yeah, Brian, because as we know, democratic rights were disastrously curtailed under George W. Bush after 9/11. And we had habeas corpus taken away, the right to challenge your own incarceration. We have indefinite detention. Guantanamo was set up and it still exists. Torture was used, and Trump brags about how he'd like to use it some more. And he says, he says it works, but he says even if we don't get anything, these people deserve to be punished. Assassination by drones is going on, including assassination of American citizens. Awar Anwaki was murdered by a drone, and 2 weeks later, his son, his 16-year-old son, was killed. And the Posse Comitatus Act, which prevented the Army from coming into the United States and serving as a domestic police force, that was taken away, and now the Army can do that. So all these terrible things that occurred under Bush were prolonged under Obama. He refused to reverse any of them, and that's the situation the Trump presidency is going to inherit. And keeping that in mind, our question to you is, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, and I just want to emphasize that President Obama did not just continue them. In some ways, expanded those aggregated powers of the chief executive to the diminution of people's rights and basic civil liberties and civil rights in the drone program. I mean, thousands of people have been assassinated during the Obama administration, and it's now an institutional form of power, and including, as you mentioned, the targeted assassinations of American citizens, of course, without due process. Yes, we have entered, and the Obama administration was the greatest prosecutor of whistleblowers who tried to expose government abuse in these areas. So here we are, under Clinton, Bill Clinton, then under George W. Bush, and then under Obama, there is the aggregation of executive power, the centralized, I would say monstrous centralized powers of the executive branch have grown to such a gargantuan degree that... And while it was fine with the Democratic elites when it was their turn to be in the White House, it obviously, in a visceral way, makes itself self-evident what the danger is under the Trump presidency. Trump has promised to deport originally 14 million immigrants. Now he says it's only going to be 3 million. Can you imagine? He's promised to ban Muslims. Now he says just foreign Muslims. He's obviously creating a Justice Department that's going to be 100% pro-police and making those who have protested in the movement for Black Lives or immigrant lives to be the targets rather than those who have a valid claim against police power. I think that we can see, based on the temper of the country, the tenor of the Trump administration, of the Trump campaign, where he said, let's do all of these things, let's find ISIS members' families and kill them, let's make torture legal again. Should there be another terrorist attack, not necessarily September 11th, just say San Bernardino-type attack, terrible as they both were, but the second one being smaller in terms of the casualty, I think under the Trump government, this right-wing extremist government, that it's certainly possible that it would move to find a way to circumspect and even maybe perhaps suspend civil liberties and civil rights that people in the United States take for granted. We certainly felt those strong feeling, that chilling feeling of that after September 11th. Thousands of Muslims and Middle Eastern peoples and South Asian peoples rounded up without rights. It diminished somewhat, but I certainly can see this coming back as a major threat. The major threat is the young Muslims who are being challenged in school, who are being abused, who are being the subject of hate crimes. Even last year before Trump, the FBI reported a 67% increase in hate crimes in the United States. That was before Trump. Under this political atmosphere, that's growing already. It will continue to grow. So what we're saying on Inauguration Day, but actually every day, including today or tomorrow, don't listen to President Obama, who says we're all part of the same team, and if President Trump succeeds, we all succeed. If President Trump succeeds with his program, big parts of the country not only don't succeed, but could end up deported, could end up detained, could end up being imprisoned, and certainly for the entire American body politic, end up losing our core basic civil rights and civil liberties. This wasn't an intramural scrimmage after which we all unite as great patriots in America, as President Obama lectured the demonstrators in the last week. We have to realize there is a clear and present danger from the extremist Trump administration, and people should be out in the streets defending their rights. Not to do so, to remain passive, well, that's inexcusable from my point of view.
Yeah, Obama said to Trump, "We're rooting for you," and Clinton said, "Let's give him a chance."
Well, they're all part of the same club, and of course, when Trump got married for the third time, Bill and Hillary Clinton were right there in the front row of the ceremony. They play golf together. I mean, it is part of the same club. It's the elites, and Trump has tried to demagogically appeal to working-class communities that have been hollowed out. But in fact, Donald Trump has nothing to offer these people except, again, a dangerous threat, diminution of everyone's rights.
Oh, Brian, you're a breath of fresh air for us.
Brian, we don't have much time left, but I wanted to ask you this question. The left in the United States, in one sense, is quite broad. The polls taken with respect to what people thought about socialism, even 3 years ago, 49% of young people under the age of 29 had a favorable reaction to socialism. They knew they didn't like capitalism. And those numbers have even increased, and we saw that reflected in the Bernie Sanders campaign. But on the other hand, the organized left is quite small. It seems to me uncoordinated. And I wondered what your thoughts are in terms of the various left-wing groups, like the Answer Coalition, coming together with other left-wing groups in some kind of unified program of reaction to defend ourselves.
Well, there should be unity in the streets, and I think there already is a great degree of it. I think that, you know, neoliberal capitalism, or what we might just call imperialism, has shown itself as being incapable of meeting the needs of the population. The problems of income inequality are not just policy problems. They're organic to this system. That's why socialism is becoming popular again. Bernie Sanders' campaign was remarkable in the sense that someone who said he was a democratic socialist could be a serious contender and probably would have won the Democratic Party and then certainly would have won the presidency in a campaign against Donald Trump. I mean, he could beat Trump. Hillary Clinton could not. All of that happened, and in spite of the fact that he was mildly red-baited in the beginning, people just kept coming out to the rallies, giving him money. Socialism is going through a period of revival. If we don't have a socialist alternative to the Wall Street corporate domination, the only answer, the only alternative will be another, quote, extreme, and that extreme will be the far right, will be the fascist, what is wrongly labeled as populism. We saw that in the 1930s as well. One out of every two Americans is either in poverty or near poverty right now. I'm also a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. In the last week, we have 200 new applications for membership just in the last week. This has been happening all year long. In other words, people who in the past would think, oh, socialism is a fringe, they're now looking for organization. They need organization. It's compelling because unless people who are socialists stand up and say, hey, I'm not afraid to be a socialist and don't form and or are unwilling to join organizations, then the organizations of the ultra-right will undoubtedly win out. This is a fight to the finish. Neoliberal capitalism is in decline, but it won't sort of die by itself. There must be an alternative created. And so the left should work together. The different organizations, I believe, all of them will start to grow right now. I think we should not be down in the dumps about Trump, even though it was a shocking outcome. The Democratic elites offer the working class communities nothing. They take them for granted. Hillary Clinton didn't visit Wisconsin once. She was defeated by Bernie Sanders in Michigan. She only visited Michigan once. And their economic program offers nothing. The left must unite. It must fight together. It must have not only a social program, but an economic program reaching many of those same workers who voted for Donald Trump, not because they love Trump, but because they want change.
Brian Becker, it's always energizing and informative to have you on. Michael and I and Jeff look forward to seeing you in the streets, in Freedom Plaza, at the inauguration. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Good luck.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Dakota Area Pipeline construction is near completion. It is designed to bring shale oil from North Dakota and South Dakota through Iowa and into Illinois. The Energy Transfer Partnership is the company building the pipeline at a cost of $3.8 billion, which it borrowed from some of the major banks in the world. The pipeline is stalled at the banks of the Missouri River, under which it intends to tunnel. Opponents of the pipeline oppose it, contending that pipelines break, and that if it does, it'll threaten the water supply of over 15 million people. Moreover, it has been dug through sacred Sioux Indian lands in violation of two treaties. And last, the burning of oil will further increase global warming and irreversibly change our climate. In the last several months, thousands of people, including over 100 Native American tribes, have camped out at Sacred Stone in North Dakota, attempting to prevent the completion of the pipeline. The Obama administration has ordered a review of the process by which consultations with Native American tribes are held concerning the pipeline. This has put a temporary hold on construction. The company and the government of North Dakota have sought to viciously suppress the protests using dogs, rubber bullets, sound cannons, beatings, and mass arrests. Our guest today, Eleanor Bravo, has just returned from the encampment. She is senior organizer for the nonprofit Food and Water Watch. Based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, she heads up a national campaign to oppose pipelines throughout the U.S. She is active in keeping drilling, fracking out of public lands, particularly in Chaco Culture National Historical Park. She works at the state and national levels to promote legislation to curb the extraction of fossil fuels. In 2008, she ran the number one field office for Barack Obama's campaign for presidency. Eleanor Bravo, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor, we'd like you to give us a brief background on what's been going on in the last week or so. I know you just got back from Standing Rock. What's it like?
Yes, I did. When I was there, things were settling down. They were peaceful. There's a lot of building going on. The people are hunkering down for a long, cold winter. They are in resolve that they will be staying there until whatever happens. So it's very busy. There are probably 5,000 to 15,000 at any given time. People come and go all the time.
Eleanor, what brought you to travel to Standing Rock, North Dakota, and what did you hope to accomplish by going there?
Well, I am the head of a campaign to oppose all pipelines in the United States with an organization called Food and Water Watch. And we work so that all people have access to clean water and safe food. And fracking is a big issue with us, and we have been long allies with the Lakota in that area. And so I went there primarily to find out how our organization could support the Native people and in their struggle there at this particular time. So I was really honored to be able to go there. It is a really special place. And I went with an open mind and an open heart. And I just want to describe to you a little bit of what it was like. We did fly into Bismarck, and we tried to drive to the camp. And we were stopped by the National Guard. They were telling us that a bridge was burnt out and we couldn't go through. So we had to turn around, and it made a one-hour trip into a two-and-a-half-hour trip. So we went all the way around. We got to the camp. We were so welcomed, and we were told this is a prayer camp, and all are welcome. And there is a meeting every morning for newcomers to learn what to do and how to behave and what to expect at the camp. So we did see a lot of military presence, but not in the camps. So we continued in, and we went to the meetings. We learned about what the structure is. And it is a city that has grown organically in tents and in yurts. And there are kitchens, probably 10, 11, 12 kitchens, feeding probably 200 to 300 people a day. Just every day, trucks come in with donated food. The food is distributed around to the kitchens. There's a medical tent. There's a mental health tent. There is a meeting tent. It is a really working camp. So I was there listening, trying to learn, and I was also meeting people that I had known before and meeting some of our allies. So it was a real learning experience. And what I would really like to communicate to people is that it is a prayer camp, and it is for not just the people there, but the police, for all of us, and for indigenous people all around the world. And that is so much of an issue there that everyone who goes there should understand that.
Eleanor, what's life like there at the camps, and what are the intentions of the leadership?
The leadership is wanting to continue and grow these camps and invite as many people to come as possible. They are also in contact with the White House. They are in contact with the press on a regular basis. There's very little service there. It's very remote. People there feel extremely isolated. But the leadership is resolved that they are going to stop this pipeline. They were very happy to hear recently that the Army Corps said they would delay. Now, this just happened this week. And unfortunately, the very next day, Energy Transfer Partners filed suit against the Army Corps saying that they had no right to delay. So things are happening quickly, and the leadership is keeping track and communicating on a regular basis. Also on Tuesday, Representative Grijalva from Arizona and Huffman from Connecticut and 21 members of Congress wrote a letter recommending in writing to President Obama to de-escalate the tensions at the Dakota Access Pipeline. Also this week, the UN had sent observers, and they sent out a very strong statement saying that the law enforcement there were using violence against the peaceful protesters and violating their human rights. So this has been a very, very busy week. We also, yesterday, had a worldwide protest in front of all of the Army Corps of Engineers offices, and I don't know what the estimates are, but it was in the millions, and it became an international event because there is one permit yet to be granted. Now, this pipeline is 60% complete, but there is one permit yet missing, and that could be granted by the Army Corps, and it is for the easement to dig under the Missouri River at that location. And that is yet pending. So we try to let the Army Corps know that we do not want that permit to be granted.
Eleanor, we just have a couple of minutes remaining. How do you think the results of the presidential election may change things for this confrontation?
Well, I want to be honest. It's going to be difficult. We want to work day to day, day by day with what we have now. We know that this new administration is are climate deniers. They are pro-corporations. But what we can accomplish now until the end of the year could have a huge effect. We are really very hopeful that we can still delay this. The more delay that we can inject into the situation, the better off we will be. But we will not change our tactics. We will continue to work grassroots, which has been very effective in the past. We have been successful in local fights, banning fracking in Monterey County in California. We're going to continue working grassroots and continue and try to support indigenous people in North Dakota and all over the world.
Eleanor Bravo from Food and Water Watch, it's a pleasure having you as a guest on Law and Disorder. Good luck on your work.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Eleanor.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.